You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I know you love podcasts. Believe it or not, there are a lot of people out there who still haven't been turned on to podcasts or don't really know what a podcast is. So help celebrate Podcast Month by sharing Kick-Ass News or any of your favorite podcasts with at least two friends. Or better yet, share us with all your friends on Twitter or Facebook and be sure to tag us when you do and use the hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. Spread the word about this podcast or any podcast. And if you want to do something else to support Kick-Ass News, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/Kick-Ass News. Believe it or not, this show costs actual money, and your contribution will help offset some of those costs. So become a part of what I'm doing here by going to GoFundMe.com/Kick-Ass News and making a donation. Thanks for listening. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's the lovely Paris Hilton. Paris. You look wonderful.
Thank you.
You look better than ever. Thank you so much for being here. How have you been? Are you all right?
Good to be back in New York City.
New York City is exciting, though, isn't it?
I was born here, yeah.
Yeah, good for you. How'd you like being in jail? God, that was just a horrible thing. God, wasn't it horrible?
Yeah, it was, definitely.
And you know what? They locked up your friend Nicole. Did you have three meals a day?
Yes.
Would you start with the breakfast?
Obviously.
What would the breakfast be?
Like a hard-boiled egg and an orange.
Well, that's not bad. Hard-boiled egg and an orange. You can't go wrong there, honestly. Because you have your protein, yeah, and you have some fruit there. That's pretty good, so you don't get scurvy. You don't want to get scurvy. Have your friends treated you differently since you've been out of the slammer?
No. People think that I was really strong, that I went through it, so.
God, it was just ugly, wasn't it? Did you, have you made
But I've moved on with my life, so I don't really want to talk about it anymore. But,
I know. Well, I appreciate that. See, now, this is where you and I are different, because this is all I want to talk about.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from the king of late night, David Letterman. In his heyday, he was appointment television for any young person who wanted to be in the know and on the cutting edge of comedy. His street pieces and comedic bits ranged from vaudevillian to dadaistic, and his folksy Midwesternness belied a wry wit and razor-sharp critique of the artifice and absurdity of show business. Carson may have been on the air longer, and Leno may have had better ratings, but no one was funnier or more relevant than David Letterman. Now, in a new book, Jason Zinnemann, the comedy critic at the New York Times, mixes groundbreaking reporting with unprecedented access and probing critical analysis to explain the unique entertainer's titanic contributions. He says, to understand popular culture today, you have to understand David Letterman. Zinnemann offers a perceptive study of the man and the artist, whose caustic voice was crucial to an entire generation of comedians and viewers, and whose singular style ushered in new tropes that have become cliches in contemporary comedy. Jason Zinnemann began his career at Time Out New York, where he became the theater editor in 2001. After writing freelance stories for the New York Times, he was hired to become the onstage and off-theater columnist in 2003, and in 2011, he became the first comedy critic at the New York Times. 2 years later, he published Searching for Dave Chappelle, a Kindle single about comedian Dave Chappelle's retreat from public life. And in 2011, he published his first book, Shock Value, about the horror movies of the late 1960s. Now he's followed that up with Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night, which is already a bestseller. And today he'll talk about the enormous cultural influence of Late Night with David Letterman in the 80s and the many ways Letterman's legacy can be seen on every late night show on television today. We'll discuss the restrictions that Johnny Carson placed on the show that came on after The Tonight Show and how those helped David Letterman stand out and create something totally different that parodied talk shows and rewrote the conventions of comedy. We'll analyze what made Letterman a far superior interviewer to Carson or Jay Leno, his amazing ability to ad-lib hilarious one-liners totally off the cuff, and his subtle and not-so-subtle digs at the phoniness of celebrity. We'll get into the legendary late-night wars between Leno and Letterman and the myth that the Oscars sank the late show's ratings. Jason will also talk about his surprisingly candid interviews with the man himself, and we'll talk about Dave's mom, who just passed away last week at the age of 95. Plus, stupid pet tricks, giant doorknobs, and more, coming up with New York Times comedy critic Jason Zinnemann. Wake up the kids and phone the neighbors, folks. New York Times comedy critic Jason Zinnemann has written a new book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Jason, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
Well, Jason, before we dig into this terrific book, you're a comedy critic. Now, to me, that almost seems like an oxymoron. You know, with movies, there's usually some type of a general agreement on what is a great movie. But when it comes to comedy, I have comedians who everyone seems to love, and I just don't get their appeal at all. And I have comics that I like, but all my friends hate them. You know, comedy seems so subjective. So how does that even work as a comedy critic?
Well, respectfully, I couldn't disagree with you more. I mean, maybe you hang out with different people than I do, but movies are tremendously subjective. People like wildly different things in movies, just as theater is wildly subjective. Some people love Arthur Miller, some people hate him. Painting is wildly subjective. Art is the bottom line is art, all art, you know, the sense of what is beautiful and truthful is all wildly subjective. So the idea that comedy is somehow different than that in terms of how objective or subjective to me, which I think, you know, some people have thought for years, is ultimately an opinion that devalues comedy, sees it as something other than art. And my point of view is, of course comedy is art. Comedy is incredibly complex, and what I think is funny is different than what someone else thinks is funny, but that certainly doesn't mean that we can't make critical judgments on it, just in the same way that the fact that one person likes one kind of play but doesn't like another kind of play doesn't mean we can't say that Shakespeare is great. So just because you might prefer Stephen Wright to George Carlin doesn't mean we can't say that George Carlin is a superb comedian. So I mean, to me, it's sort of like the assumption out of his strength is one I take issue with.
So somewhere out there, there's a critic who might like Carrot Top?
Of course. Well, there are Carrot Top isn't playing to empty audiences. I mean, I think this is actually far more interesting. I take it as a point of pride. I've been a critic for a long time, but there's some critics who have very narrow aesthetics. But I think it's important as a critic to try to have pretty Catholic tastes, to try to have to see things on their own terms, and to have appreciate the widest variety of things that you can. And even if something is not to your taste, to say, oh, they're doing what they're doing well. So I, for instance, you know, I've gone to Beaumont, Texas, to review Larry the Cable Guy. who is not to my taste, but you know what that guy does on his own terms should be looked at with a rigorous critical eye, because he's impressive and he's got a huge audience. Now you could say they're all fools, but I think there's a lot of work for a critic to do there. And I think the same, I mean, you're making a joke about Carrot Top, but a good critic, you know, looks at, just as you would look at what a reality show is doing seriously, you could look at what Carrot Top's doing seriously.
Yeah. Now, if I may, who are your favorite comedians personally?
I mean, I have a pretty wide, I wrote a book about one of them, David Letterman. Mm-hmm. So that he would be on the list. I love, Steve Martin. I love Richard Pryor. Carlin would be on that list. Then there's just a slew of comedians today. I mean, I write about comedy every other week. So, I think Rory Scovel did probably the best comedy set I saw of last year. Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle, people who I have a lot of respect for. So, the list goes on and on.
Yeah. And is there anyone in the alt comedy scene that we might want to keep our eye on right now?
I think there was a time when what was alt comedy was very clear. There was alt comedy and club comedy. Mm-hmm. I think right now it's harder to really say what is alt comedy, since that has gone so mainstream. So for instance, the comedian I mentioned who was, had the best set that I've seen all last year, Rory Scovel. Mm-hmm. That he's a very non-traditional comic. A lot of his work is improvisational.
Right.
He's, I think to a lot of, he may be alienating to a lot of people. I think he in the 90s would firmly fit in the alt comedy sphere, but he's playing clubs. He plays Carolines. He'd be somebody who I'd recommend. I think Cape Berlant, if you really have an adventurous taste, Cape Berlant, I think, is really brilliant. John Early is really great. Those were some other people.
Well, the subject of your new book was kind of alt comedy before there was such a thing as alt comedy. You got to interview David Letterman himself for the book. He has a reputation for being notoriously evasive in interviews. How was he with you?
One of the things that was a little bit of a surprise is that he did not dodge in this interview. He was direct. He answered every question. He was charming. He was serious. He was a great interview, which, I'd heard that from a person or two, but I'd also read a bunch of interviews with him where, he was, as you described, elusive. So I didn't know what to expect. I think I had the benefit that I talked to him 9 months after his show was over. He had a little time to reflect, and it wasn't under some tight deadline pressure or it wasn't for some promotional reason. He seemed tremendously relaxed and eager to, to talk. I think also I had spent, a couple years in reporting and talking to people from, from his childhood through to the end of his career. So, these are hundreds of people who I talked to. So I think to some degree, the interview had a kind of this is your life feel.
You spend close to 2/3 of the book focusing on the early years and Late Night with David Letterman, his original show, as opposed to the show on CBS. When Dave took over for Tom Snyder in that 12:30 slot after Carson and launched Late Night with David Letterman, what was the competition like at that hour?
There was hardly any. The competition was late night movies and infomercials. And while you maybe you were watching a late night horror movie show or something, hosted by Elvira or something. but if you weren't doing that, you were watching Letterman. So Letterman, that's the fundamental difference. And also, frankly, part of why Letterman is such a meaningful cultural figure is that, today, if you at 12:30 at night and you have an interest in irreverent comedy, you can go online, Netflix, you can look at YouTube. There's countless number of channels which are showing interesting things at all hours of the day. But at 12:30 at night in 1982, if you were interested in adventurous comedy, chances are you were watching David Letterman. It's at a time when sort of the cultural campfire was one that was much bigger. than it is today. So everyone had this thing in common who mm-hmm. came from this bent, and that was why he had such an impact, or one of the reasons why.
Yeah, and the story has always been that Letterman did so well in the early days because he was popular with college kids in this very young, hip demographic that advertisers were dying to get. Was it sort of the beginning of this shift from just counting eyeballs to actually targeting specific demos?
I do think that's true. That was a shift, and an important one. And, you know, I'm not sure it's for the good, to be totally honest with you. You know, I think that for a while was also the justification for shows that got lower ratings. They said, well, we got fewer people watching, but the right demo was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the right demo was young men. So why we're giving this huge amount of cultural power to young men to shape what our entertainment options are, because advertisers are telling us that young men are going to lead to sell more stuff. First of all, I've always been very skeptical of this, and every time I met someone in advertising, I pressed them on it, because it just seems contrary to actual lived experience that, like, a 20-year-old, I know there's all sorts of reasons for this, but that seems odd to me. And even if it is true, it seems like the impact of that is to shut out huge portions of this country. I remember when I did a story for the Times on Amy Schumer when her show was starting, and I, you know, talked to the people at Comedy Central about this, and, you know, they were really focused when that show started on, you know, are men going to watch the show, because their demographic was young men. You know, why couldn't you have a show on Comedy Central that had a majority female audience? And it's not hard to then conclude that part of the reason we have fewer women on late night was because of this idea that may be untrue about the power of young male demographic for advertisers.
And one of the things that I found most interesting in this book is how the style and the tone of Late Night with David Letterman was sort of born out of the fact that it was actually produced by Johnny Carson's production company, and Carson had a bunch of stipulations over what David Letterman could and couldn't do on his show at 12:30. What were some of those contractual restrictions that I guess really ended up making Late Night with David Letterman what it was?
Well, they were had to do with, they couldn't have an orchestra. There were certain guests. They had to go through the Tonight Show to okay guests, not have overlapped in terms of guests. I believe they didn't want to have a big monologue. You know, that there's some disagreement here over, you know, essentially David Letterman put on this show that was wildly different than it had been on in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that to many fans looked like the antithesis of the Tonight Show. Now, why is that? So one narrative is that Carson put these rules down, and because of that, they create, you know, they didn't do the same thing. But I think that doesn't really explain the whole story. I mean, I don't think that the people who were making David Letterman, who were people like, you know, George Meyer, who went on to help write The Simpsons, and Meryl Marco, who was Letterman's longtime collaborator, they didn't want to put on a show like Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to put on a show that was the backbone was a long topical monologue. They didn't want to put on a show which had a huge old school big band orchestra. It made sense. So in a way, those rules, which have gotten some attention, were kind of beside the point. It sort of emphasized and gave more conviction to the people making these choices that were probably already going to happen anyways.
And in some ways, it sort of parodied the form of the late night talk show. You know, if you watch talk shows today, hosts kiss celebrities' ass so much. But the beauty of Letterman was that he seemed so uninterested in movie stars and showbiz, which I guess sort of tapped into this growing skepticism of celebrity in the 80s, huh?
Yeah, I think it stood out then, and it stands out now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's there's this sense that you know, when David Letterman started that show, that the talk show had this very chummy relationship to show business and celebrity and Hollywood, and that it was a forum to promote your movie, and that's why movie stars went on the show, and that's why the hosts responded, you know, as if every movie that came on was worthy of seeing. And I think after years and years of this, audiences started to distrust these shows. They started to seem fake. They started to seem artificial. They started to seem like it was sales, not comedy. And then Letterman came along, and he said what everyone was already thinking, which is, this is all nonsense. This is all phony, right? And by doing that, he may have alienated some people in Hollywood, but this audience who had been watching this fakery for so long thought, finally, here's someone who's saying what we think. And by doing that, he seemed like this incredibly authentic guy.
And one example that you talk about in the book that I can remember was when Billy Idol came on, who was the exact type of phony that David Letterman didn't particularly care for, this fake punk rocker.
Right.
How did David Letterman play that?
Well, it's hilarious. It's fascinating. I mean, people, they should go and look it up on YouTube. It's you know, what I write about is, on the surface, if you had the volume off, it looks like Letterman's the square and Billy Idol is the rebel, right? Because Billy Idol's got the leather coat and the spiky blonde hair and the scowl. Letterman looks like he's got the tie and the shortcut hair. But if you listen to it, and Billy Idol's trying to be really flamboyant, outrageous, and talking about drugs and all this. But, you know, he's basically just peddling a different image that has already sold well and that is tired and hacked by the time that he's doing it. I mean, he's doing some warmed-over, more mainstream version of the Sex Pistols, where Letterman, as opposed to playing the square in this sort of show business drama, he gives it right back to him and kind of mocks him very subtly. And he almost embraces, like, he has some line where he's like, your mother must be very proud of you, or something like that, which is both co-opting the language of like an old fogey, but doing it in a way that is, you know, sharply sarcastic and critical. And he comes off more counterculture than Billy Idol does.
Well, the drug dealers in Westforth call their drugs by my names and my songs, like there's White Wedding, Cocaine, and Rebel Yell Quaaludes, and Dancing With Myself, Smoke and stuff. So, yeah, people recognize me everywhere, really.
You must be a very proud young man.
I mean, it's an incredible act of comedic jujitsu, and it really explains why I think, and I think this is a somewhat unpopular position, but that Letterman was a tremendous interviewer.
Yeah,
that was compelling to watch somebody go after Billy Idol like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's funny to read in your book how many people thought that he wasn't a good interviewer in the beginning. I think that he was probably the best.
I agree.
When I look back at Carson and Leno, who had pre-written jokes to shoehorn into an interview, and I compare it to Dave, Dave had this easy give and take with guests, and he was able to just magically ad-lib these hilarious lines completely organically out of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put your finger on, I mean, there's nobody been better at ad-libbing, although many people say Steve Allen was also incredible. But I think the addition is that he was willing to be antagonistic. Now he did it in his way, but you know that why should every conversation on a late night talk show be amiable? It's boring to have the same kind of conversation. So Letterman was willing to show a broader range of emotions, including skepticism. And you know, I think. Since Letterman, you've seen interviewers like, you know, Jon Stewart and The Daily Show
Right. Get
really antagonistic and almost prosecutorial. But it seems less exceptional now, although I think you don't see it much anymore because we've sort of ceded it to cable news. But Letterman showed you, you know, a wide range of kinds of conversations. That I think the main reason I liked it as a viewer is you just never know what was going to happen.
Yeah, there was this bizarre juxtaposition where he had this totally nonchalant attitude toward the things that impressed most people, big Hollywood stars and Washington politicians. But then he would give these huge buildups to these completely hokey bits like stupid pet tricks or some ridiculously large prop.
Yes, definitely. No, you're absolutely right. I think that was very pointed that, you know, Kmar, the discount magician, was brought on again and again and again. I mean, he could have gotten better magician. Mm-hmm. And, or as you say, like the giant doorknob is just going on and on about how incredible, you know, part of the joke of stupid pet tricks is how much he built it up, the hype, how much he hyped it and promoted it. And of course, there's a satirical element of that. So, and then these movie stars would come on. I mean, you look at the first interview that Letterman did was with Bill Murray, who was, you know, incredibly hot, you know, coming off of Saturday Night Live. And, you know, Letterman's first question, he basically said, you know, I don't really care what the answer to this is. And then he asked some question about some mundane thing. And it's just like, I think that says a lot that the first thing out of his mouth is, I don't care. And, and the truth is, you know, this kind of stuff that was typically talked about on these talk shows is not worth your attention most of the time. Mm-hmm. And Letterman just had the guts to point it out.
He thought that he was the heir apparent to Johnny Carson, and he desperately wanted The Tonight Show to the point that it was sort of his white whale. How much was he willing to give up to get The Tonight Show?
Well, I'm not sure that he was willing to give up so much. I think he definitely wanted to host The Tonight Show, and that was...
He certainly would have taken a pay cut compared to CBS, right?
Yes, but, I mean, you could argue... You know, this goes into the whole late night war. He hired Michael Ovitz, and Michael Ovitz was a hard driving bargainer. And I think he says, you know, Michael Ovitz said early on, he saw that, you know, CBS would be the best place for him. And I think you can imagine one could look at an alternative history and imagine, all right, say Letterman didn't hire such a hard driving bargainer. And he said, he went to NBC and said, look, we'll take, you know, a more modest amount. And maybe things might have played out. I don't think they would have.
Yeah.
But I think to the point you're getting at, he, you know, they had been taught. One thing I learned in the course of researching this book is that, you know, Letterman had been in talks or had been rumored to replace Johnny Carson since 1979, before he even had a talk show, when he was just a popular guest host. So year after year after year after year of people saying you're up for, you know, maybe the most prized job for comedian in television has an impact. So when it finally came to the time when Carson left and it went to Leno, I think it was definitely devastating.
Yeah, and I almost wonder, do you think that he might have had a similar fate to Conan O'Brien if he had taken over The Tonight Show and tried to make it his rather than building his own show on another network?
It's an interesting question. It's possible. It's hard to tell. I mean, my guess is the thing would have played out the same way. That the NBC would have stuck with him, and maybe CBS would have hired Leno. And the duel would have gone on the same way. And, you know, they were fundamentally different style performers with different strengths. And I think that Letterman's legacy was much greater. I think there's no question that Leno had a kind of populist sensibility that got higher ratings for a long time.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with New York Times comedy critic Jason Zinnemann. When we come back in just a moment. Folks, as you can probably tell, I am a voracious consumer of news, especially magazines. But magazines can be a lot of clutter, so I recently got turned on to Texture, which gives me access to all of my favorite magazines like The New Yorker, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and Vanity Fair, all without the paper and whenever I want. You know, at a time when it feels like it's never been harder to find the truth, supporting the free press is critically important. And Texture gives you access not just to your favorite magazines, but also to some of the most credible publications in the world, all on your phone or tablet. Not to mention, with daily recommendations, exclusive interactive features, videos, and more, Texture makes it easy to find and enjoy the articles you want to read from all of your favorite magazines like The Atlantic, Fast Company, and Entertainment Weekly. It's even searchable, so you can mark what you like, check out back issues, or view bonus content. No wonder it's one of Apple's top 2016 iPad apps. Best of all, Texture is normally $9.99 a month for access to over 200 magazines, but if you sign up right now at texture.com/kickass, you get a 14-day free trial. Why would you subscribe to just a couple of magazines when you can have all of your favorites all the time for way less? Just go to texture.com/kickass for your 14-day free trial. That's 14 days to try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/kickass. One more time, that's texture.com/kickass. Folks, you know how obsessive I am about getting a good night's sleep. And so much of that comes down to what you're sleeping on. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foams create an award-winning sleep surface that has just the right sink and just the right bounce. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Because Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. They have free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the Internet's favorite mattress. And right now, they have a special offer for listeners of the show. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/kick and using the offer code KICK. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's casper.com/kick and offer code KICK. Here's something to look forward to. Amazon's acclaimed crime series, Bosch, is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who's obsessed with punishing criminals no matter what the cost. Haunted by the discovery that his mother's murder was covered up by the police, Bosch also finds himself implicated in the death of a serial killer he's investigating. Now Bosch must navigate the dangerous waters of a police department that believes he's guilty while working with a partner who is no longer sure he can trust him. Bosch will fight to prove his innocence even as he pursues a dangerous group of ex-Special Forces assassins willing to kill anyone who gets in their way. Against the glamour and seediness of Los Angeles, Bosch will risk everything to clear his name while bringing down the murderous crime ring, no matter how many rules he has to break to do it. Based on the best-selling novels by Michael Connelly, stream Season 3 on Amazon Prime April 21st. And now, back to the podcast. When he went over to CBS, there was an obvious shift in the style and tone of the show, and I was interested to read that it had less to do with the earlier time slot or the new network than it did with just the location of the show. How did the Ed Sullivan Theater change his show?
Well, I think, you know, the show at late night was in a small studio. And the Ed Sullivan Theater is just physically a much, it's not only there's a more seats, but it's a bigger scale. It's tall, you know. And one of the, you know, great things about late night is that they used the backstage and the offices and the other studios down the hall as part of their comedy. And it had a kind of clubhouse feel. And the claustrophobia of it came through. Where when you move to CBS, they eventually found ways to use the surrounding areas nicely. But, you know, they had to deal with the same thing Steve Colbert has to deal with, which is that this is a big theater. And if you have a big theater, you've got to put on a big show. Or else it will look dwarfed by the theater. And so I think and this is true, you know, if you go, you look at a play that is doing well off Broadway, and it moves to a big Broadway house, it has to adjust.
Yeah.
You have to make the sets bigger. You have to project more. This is just how showbiz works. And I think in some ways, you know, that was destiny. Now, I do think moving to 11:30 was important, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a sense back then that 11:30, you know, you've got to reach a bigger audience. You got to be a little broader. Maybe you're not going to take as many formal risks. And also, at the same time, I think Letterman was getting older and he was evolving.
He was winning the late night wars with Leno for, I think, about the first year. And then Leno began beating him in the ratings. What was the turning point? Was it the Oscars? Was it Hugh Grant?
You know, Bill Carter wrote a great book on the late night war. So I didn't want to go too deep into all the details of it because it had been already written. But I did want to examine the kind of assumptions about why Letterman started to lose to Leno. And you know, the common wisdom is that it's sort of the 1-2 punch of the hosting the Oscars was a disaster. And then the Hugh Grant interview for Leno went so well that then he started to lose. And that was pushed by NBC. And that was the explanation. This always struck me as a pretty poor reasoning. So how could one interview with Hugh Grant really change the fortunes of these show for the next couple of decades? It seemed tolerant. And moreover, the Oscars in particularly seemed crazy because, first of all, I didn't think he did that badly. I actually enjoyed his host of the Oscars. Second of all, the ratings were...
I did too.
Yeah, the ratings weren't that bad. And then once I looked back, I mean, they were quite good, actually. When I looked back at the press coverage, the reviews were mixed. Now, what happened? So this is one of the things that I had a hypothesis that I tested, which is that I looked at every single joke Letterman told about him hosting the Oscars in his monologue over many years. And just the fact that he made jokes about him hosting the Oscars for 3 years and more, 4 or 5 years, says something. And what I discovered is that, you know, the week after he hosted, his jokes about the Oscars portrayed him as being embarrassed, but not, you know, that he didn't do necessarily a terrible job. And then, like, 5 months later, his jokes were that, oh, this was, you know, a real catastrophe. And then, like, a year later, it was like a genocide. Mm-hmm. And then that became the reputation. And my sort of working theory is that, you know, Letterman, more than anybody else, helped create this reputation that he did terribly at the Oscars through his own self-deprecating sense of humor. And what's fascinating about that is what you see is that, you know, the same thing that made Letterman great, which is precisely his self-deprecating sense of humor, also could have a negative side.
Yeah, and you talk about how there was this constant theme of his self-criticism, how he was never happy with the previous night's show. He was always looking at the ratings. Did he ever manage to get over that?
I think he did start to care less about the rating. I think it was clear that, you know, he wasn't as obsessed with the ratings at the end as he was during the heat of the late night war.
Mm-hmm.
Was he happier? You know, after his son was born, he seemed happier. But to be honest, he seems happy as right now. When I see him introducing Pearl Jam at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, when I see, he seems very content. I think his temperament, you know, he was a perfectionist and he, you know, always thought he was messing up. And I think that is one of the key personality traits that dominates that show on every level. That to the extent of that, I didn't realize before I started working on this book, but you know, when you talk to all the people who worked for him over years, many, many years, it's a consistent refrain.
Mm-hmm. I once heard someone say that the only time David Letterman was truly happy was that 1 hour a day when he was on the air. Having studied and interviewed the guy, does that ring true to you?
Yes. I mean, it might be a little bit of an overstatement because there's some, but I think it's true. I read about in the book, there are moments in his life when the show is a kind of an escape for him, is cathartic for him. There's moments when, you know, the show seems like an albatross.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, there's no question that he, when he's performing, I think he loves performing. There's no question. I mean, that's why I think you know, in his retirement, he's not gonna be like Johnny Carson and just completely vanish.
Yeah.
And I think you see that now. You know, he's been out and about quite a bit in the last couple months.
In the 2000s, he became a little less adventurous and more focused on the interview than the monologue or the comedy bits. Do you know what the impetus was for that shift?
You know, there's several explanations here. I think he says that, you know, this is the natural evolution of a performer, and he became more interested in, you know, conversation and off-the-cuff stuff. And, you know, Leno had his kind of monologue with his jokes, you know, written jokes. And this was the, so he would, to distinguish himself, that was his strength. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Mm-hmm. I argue in the book that there's also had to do with the structure of the show, that after his heart attack in 2000, he stopped going to rehearsal. And when you don't go to rehearsal, and you don't see head writers, you don't hear what the bits are until, you know, soon before the show starts, that limits the ambition of what the kind of comedy can do.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that was his choice, maybe it wasn't, maybe it's a combination of just, you know, things that happened to the show, whatever it was. I think the, you know, from my reporting suggests that cutting out rehearsal had a big impact. I also think that, you know, that when the show began, they had really dynamic writers who pushed Letterman to go a little outside his comfort zone. And then when he became hugely successful, he wasn't going to be pushed around, and he was doing exactly what he wanted to do. And you know, one thing that's true of Letterman, which I think is true of many artists and writers and everybody, is that what he thinks he's really good at isn't necessarily the thing that he's really good at.
Huh.
So to take an example, Letterman was absolutely brilliant in moments off the cuff when he was surprised.
Right.
But he turns out he hated being surprised. He wanted to know exactly what was going to happen. And in the morning show, in the early years of the late night show, the you know, his staff would kind of jerry rig surprises. So, you know, in the morning show, there's one incredible episode where they actually locked the door that he's supposed to enter to begin the show. And Howard Gurney set up a camera up high backstage to see him try to get the door open and frantically, you know, panic, and then have to deal with that on air, on live television. I mean, that was great TV.
Yeah.
This also happened in ways that weren't as contrived. Like, on the morning show, at the end of this one episode, there were some sparklers that got some confetti and started a fire. And so you had a fire on set, and Letterman had to respond to that. That was great television. Letterman sort of decided he hated, or, you know, he didn't want surprise. He didn't like when guests came on and did things that wasn't unexpected. And, you know, I would argue, and again, this is just my critical opinion, the other people can disagree with me, is that something was lost with that. That's just one example. You know, when you're considering this question of the difference between what Letterman is good at versus what he thinks he's good at, you know, you have to keep in mind that this is a guy who is persistently self-critical. Letterman was genius at so many things and perceptive at so many things. In a weird way, he was, some of his blind spots had to do with himself. He didn't realize how good he was in a lot of ways.
Throughout those early years on Late Night, you always had this sense with that wry smile that there was more to this guy, but you could never really get to know him. But toward the last decade or so of The Late Show on CBS, he started to kind of let the audience in a little and revealed himself to be sort of this earnest, neurotic, likable human being, particularly in the 9/11 episode, which I think was the first of any of the late night shows to go back
right,
on
right.
the air after 9/11.
No, that was one of his greatest moments. And it was tremendously important to the country and New York. And, you know, he spoke with, you know, bracing honesty and vulnerability to the country at a time when people were really confused and lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he articulated the way a lot of people were feeling. And there was a gravitas to him that day that not many other comedians could access. That kind of direct, I think, for a guy who for his career was known for emotional distance and irony, he was being direct, earnest, sincere, and vulnerable. And when, you know, a guy with that history is speaking so earnestly, it carries a real profound impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, ratings aside, I don't think anyone can argue that Leno or anyone else was a bigger cultural legacy. Even the former head of programming at NBC who picked Leno over Letterman, Warren Littlefield, admits as much. Talk a little bit about that legacy and what David Letterman started.
Well, I mean, Letterman reinvented the talk show. I think you see he created the template for adventurous, form-breaking humor that is still being imitated by talk show hosts today. He mainstreamed a kind of ironic distance in comedy that now we just completely take for granted. That's pervasive. And, you know, he established all these he introduced all these kind of more marginal characters and comedians into network television, which I think did have an influence on alternative comedy. Now, to your point, what's interesting is that I'm not sure there's still people who don't think that his artistic success means that he won the Late Night War. There was a review of the book, my book, by, I think, a producer from Jay Leno, who said, you know, who is Jason Zinnemann? He to decide who won the Late Night War. It's the viewers who decided. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the guy is articulating what I think has been the assumption behind most of the coverage of late night television, which is that whoever has a higher number in the ratings is the winner, is better. Which is preposterous when you take any kind of historical view. I mean, and I would argue that when you look back on it, who cares if 500,000 more people watched Jay Leno in 1993? Who cares? It's like not like anybody remembers how many more books somebody sold than James Joyce. Like, James Joyce is great because of reasons that have to do with other than how many books he sold. You know, art is not measured, art can be measured by sales, but it's not the only measure of sales. So to answer this Jerry Reynolds producer, you know, I how many people watch Jay Leno matters, he's right, but what critics and historians say also matters. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I would argue that if you look at history, that things like sales and ratings points and advertising is going to matter less and less as time goes on.
Yeah.
And other people are going to matter more.
It is kind of ridiculous calling it the late night wars when both networks were making money hand over fist.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, quibbling over 500,000 viewers.
They're both winning. They're both making lots of money. Everyone's making, both talk show hosts are making lots of money. The whole thing is a little bit silly.
Yeah, and if you really want to talk about all of these current late-night shows, none of which existed before Letterman, aside from The Tonight Show, from Kimmel to Jimmy Fallon, Conan, watch any of those guys for 5 minutes, and you'll see a direct influence from David Letterman. But there's no one out there trying to imitate Jay Leno in late night.
I completely agree. I mean, you know, even these talk shows are very different than Letterman, but they still have his influence is great. I mean, Jimmy Fallon does this bit where he inhaled helium and talked to his guests.
Mm-hmm.
Letterman did that in the 80s. James Corden did early on. He shot a show in somebody else's house, which got very good reviews. Letterman did that. Some of the kind of remotes that are very common, both, you know, like Seth Meyers and Conan, were completely pioneered by David Letterman. The same thing, those remotes are also, you know, these remotes which use, you know, people on the street, ordinary civilians, and turn them into comedic characters through editing and, you know, attitude. This is the kind of thing that is the bread and butter of The Daily Show and Comedy Central. You know, that didn't really exist before Dave Letterman, with, you know, a few exceptions, like Steve Allen did versions of it. But I would say that the real lineage between in those remotes has to do with the connection between The Daily Show and Letterman. So so his influence was titanic. And you see it when, you know, when he went off the air. There was the month or more when he off the air, you know, the outpouring of emotion and celebration was quite distinct from when Jay Leno went off the air. Take nothing away from Leno. Leno was tremendously successful, and, you know, in some ways, we might look back and be more impressed with the fact that he won on the ratings for so many years, and is, you know, a great joke writer. So just take nothing away, but I don't think Jay Leno had the impact that Letterman did, and for that matter, I think probably maybe more controversially, I don't think Johnny Carson did either.
Yeah,
I think Johnny Carson was certainly more popular, and he perhaps made more careers. He was more important as a gatekeeper, although Letterman did too. People like Pee Wee Herman got exposure on Late Night, which was very important. But I think as a comedian, Letterman's fingerprints are all over the culture much more than Carson.
David Letterman's mom just died, I think, at the age of 95.
Yep.
I remember her from when he would call her on the phone or when he sent her to the Olympics as his correspondent. She seemed so sweet on TV, but you say, you know, she wasn't very affectionate and she actually withheld approval, which certainly must have driven some of Dave's neuroses. Now, the same need for mom's approval was something that haunted Johnny Carson until his dying day. Dave and his mom seemed to get along pretty well on TV, so I'm wondering if things eventually warmed up between the two of them.
Honestly, I have no idea.
No.
What I do know is that, you know, which I wrote about in the Times today, that, you know, his mom was a consistent and spectacular presence on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Starting, she first appeared in 85, but she was a regular. He would call in the early 90s and do bits. When he moved to CBS, she was an on-air correspondent and participated in three different Winter Olympics. And I think she really humanized him in a lot of ways. I mean, she seemed like, you know, the every mom and was unflappable. I think when you saw him relate to his mom when he's teasing her, and he's, you know, they're having these very kind of relatable interactions. He seemed like somebody who was, it warmed him up, first of all, but it also seemed like someone you could relate to, which, you know, for a guy who's a mega famous superstar whose default mode was ironic detachment, that was very important to make a connection with the audience. So, you know, his mom, he got the idea to put his mom on to incorporate it from listening to Howard Stern. Howard Stern also
really?
Did that. He would have called his mom's radio show.
Huh.
And so it's very sad that his mom passed away, but she lived a long life since she was 95.
Yeah.
And, you know, by all accounts, you know, a wonderful woman who lived a full life.
Do you have a favorite bit or sketch that he would do?
My favorite recurring bit is probably, I mean, I love viewer mail. I mean, the remotes, I think. There's a remote with a woman named Colleen Boyle from the mid-80s, which is started with a viewer mail. She wrote a letter about his shoes, like, you know, what's the deal with your shoes or something. And then he took the camera out to her house, which is like way out in the suburbs, and she wasn't there, but her brother was home. And he mowed her lawn, and he rifled through her closets, and then he went to visit her at this shopping mall she worked at, and then it had kind of a nice arc at the end, and it really has all the parts of Letterman that are fantastic. His ad-libbing, the editing of this remote is just ingenious. Hal Gurney has a brilliant cutaway. It's sarcastic but also kind of sweet. So That's probably high. If I had to choose one, that might be that one. But there's, you know, another day I might say Just Bulbs. Another day I might say this sketch show, They Took My Show Away. There's many interviews I love. Like, you know, I love Letterman's interviews with Stern. I love Letterman's interviews with Sandra Bernhardt. I could go on and on.
Toward the end of your interview with Dave, you asked him what was the single most underrated quality in a talk show host. What did he say?
Well, he made a joke because I told him after I asked him that question, I said that I asked Leno the same question, and Leno said, kindness. So I said to Letterman, I said, well, what's the most undervalued? And I said, I should tell you first that Leno said kindness, and Letterman took a long pause, and he looked very thoughtful, and he looked at me, and he said, in the quintessentially sarcastic way, kindness. And it was the kind of thing where on paper it doesn't look that stinging, but anyone who knows Letterman knows what he meant there, which is just mocking the idea that the most, you know, this valuable trait is kindness, and the kind of, you know, what that says about the person who would say that. And clearly, I think saying that by Leno is a little bit of a subtle dig on Letterman.
Yeah.
Because he was known for being a little more acerbic than Leno.
Well, the book is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Jason Zinnemann, thanks for talking with me.
This has been really fun. Thanks for having me.
Just a reminder, folks, that Amazon's Bosch is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who's obsessed with punishing criminals no matter what the cost. Based on the best-selling novels by Michael Connelly, stream Season 3 on Amazon Prime April 21st. Thanks again to Jason Zinnemann for joining me on the podcast. You can order Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night on Amazon, or download the audiobook for free with a special promotion for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can read Jason's regular column in the New York Times and follow him on Twitter at Zinnemann. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.